Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 333rd episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I am a professor at the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and a professor at the University of Alberta.
And I'm going to say a word that makes you and I shudder, Mike. Guidelines.
Oh, James, I thought we weren't going to swear on these podcasts.
We're just kidding. We love them. No, we're kidding about that too.
Remember, this is a PG-rated podcast.
So exactly.
Nothing too raunchy.
No. So what we thought we would do over, we're not actually sure how long this will go, but we thought we'd do sort of a, if you will, a systematic review of guidelines and talk about, and insist, when I say systematic, I don't mean specifically systematic, but we're going to run through a whole bunch of issues associated with guidelines. Now, for those of you who've been listening,
when I say evidence, I don't mean evidence.
No, I don't mean evidence. But what we want to do is we've mentioned guidelines, I think, a couple of times in the previous podcasts.
Maybe once or twice at the beginning.
Yeah, and we thought we'd just go over sort of the thought process that we use when it comes to guidelines, and also the actual evidence around guidelines, because, you know, we may have touched on it, but I don't think we've done a sort of a systematic conversation specifically about them. And so that's going to be the plan for the next, we're not sure how many podcasts.
Yeah, that's right. And we're going to address the question that I think many people have is, are they the gold standard of the way we should practice?
Exactly. Yeah.
And we'll deal with a lot of issues that speak to that.
Yeah. And what's interesting, just even as a start off, is that, you know, if you look at PubMed, the number of guidelines that were identified in PubMed, before 1985 is almost close to zero. And then there's been a sort of an explosion of the number of guidelines, you know, since, sort of the 1990s. And, you know, we now have lots of guidelines. And what we want to do is sort of work you through that sort of thought process. And I think we can phrase it, Mike, I think, if you would, is that regardless of whether one likes guidelines or doesn't like guidelines, our principles are that we think, you know, pretty much all healthcare providers should just have their practice underpinned by the best available evidence. That's really where we're coming from. If guidelines can do that, brilliant. If they can't, that's where we have issues.
Yeah, and we know for sure there are issues. We're going to talk about some of the issues of relying on guidelines, but the alternative for you is not great either, like trying to critically have a clinical question in practice and do a critical appraisal of that.
You're exactly.
Hours to address a single question, and if you're going to try and read to keep up to date, well, over 10 years ago, Alper and some people published an article showing that you need to read 21 hours every single day as a primary care provider to keep up with the evidence.
Yeah.
And that was 2004.
No, exactly.
The chances you can do that now are slim.
Yeah. And there are a number of reasons why we actually, I think, people are keen on having guidelines, because, medical history, and this is a quote from an older article, is that medical history is littered with actual clinical practice guidelines that have been fatally incorrect, you know, ones that have been very poorly put together.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and just as you mentioned, it's really difficult for people to keep up, and, you know, there's a big demand from patients for more participation in medical decision-making and so on. So there's lots of good reasons for why to have good guidelines, and so let's sort of go through that process of what is a good guideline. And I think, but why don't we start with a definition, Mike?
Why don't we start with a definition?
It's a very good place to start. So the Institute of Medicine defines a clinical practice guideline as statements that include recommendations intended to optimize patient care that are informed by a systematic review of evidence and an assessment of the benefits and harms of alternative care options. That's a nice statement.
It is good.
If they were like that. I'm not saying they aren't, because we haven't gotten there yet, but that statement is exactly what I think most people believe they are. You know what I mean? Well,
yeah, and I think it's reasonable to hope that might be what they actually are.
Yeah. Oh, no. One would hope, yeah.
And to set a goal, an aspiration, if you will.
Yes. And so, if that was true, then the number of guidelines that you would have to look at, if they were that good, if you go to the National Guideline Clearinghouse, which is one of the many places where you can find clinical practice guidelines, but if you go there, there's around 10,000 guidelines. And I did a very rough assessment that if you piled them all one on top of the on top of each other, they'd be about 6 meters high, or no, not 6 meters, about 10 meters high.
And what if they toppled on you?
Pardon?
What if they toppled on you?
Yeah, exactly. It would kill you. It's the equivalent of about, and again, using just off the sort of side of my desk math, it's the equivalent of 70 copies of War and Peace. Which, if you know what War and Peace is, it's
probably better reading.
Yes, exactly. So, so there's a lot of guidelines, and there's no possible way you guys can all read them, and in fact, you can find them many places. I mean, when you go looking for where you can find them, the Canadian Medical Association has what they call an infobase, and we'll put all of this in a handout for this material. I know you're familiar with the National Guideline Clearinghouse, Mike.
Yes. Yeah. You know, I'm on there every day.
And there's the UK has their version of that. Australia has their versions. TRIP, which is Turning Research into Practice, has a database of that. But one of the best ways, if you want to find out if there's a guideline, you can just either do a PubMed search, or if you just do what I do for virtually everything, is now I just do Google searches.
Yeah, so as James was indicating, there are so many examples of the growth of guidelines. So Ross Upshur in Annals of Family Medicine look quickly at the number of mentions of guidelines on PubMed in 1990, and the number was somewhere around 100 or something like that, very tiny. And then in 2012, he looked again at that time, and there was well over 7,000 mentions of guidelines that same year. So, 22 years apart, and it's just exploded. And then the cardiology guidelines, these people didn't look at the number of guidelines, but instead looked at the number of recommendations. So not only are the number of guidelines growing, but the number of recommendations within guidelines are growing. So it went from around 1,300 recommendations for a guideline set to almost 2,000 recommendations for the updated versions. So guidelines are growing in numbers almost exponentially.
Yeah.
And within them, the recommendations in the individual guidelines are also increasing in number. So it is definitely becoming an overwhelming issue of volume.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost getting to the stage where we now have to have a review of adding guidelines in a meta-analysis together, because that's what we kind of do. There's no way anyone can keep up with all the specific medical literature, so we knew that. And now we're making it impossible to keep up with all the number of guidelines.
For sure there are. Yeah. It is truly impossible to keep up.
Well, yeah. So there's lots of them. And so what we thought we would do is, obviously not, I know you're going to find this hard to believe, Mike, but not every one of those guidelines is perfect.
Stop it.
I know I'm being a bit cynical.
So close to Christmas and you just have to turn it into a downer, don't you?
Exactly. But so there are actually ways. You know, we spend a lot of time talking about how do you do assessments of clinical trials or randomized controlled trials, and I think we've even done some stuff on how you look at cohorts and so on. But there actually is there are tools that are used to sort of comprehensively look at or validate, if you will, clinical practice guidelines. And there was an old version of something called AGREE, which was the appraisal of guidelines for research and evaluation. And I think there's now a thing called AGREE 2. And we're not going to, at least I'm not going to, Mike might, but I'm not going to bore you with all the details of it. But they look at primarily six domains, and there's a whole bunch of sub things under those domains. And the only reason I'm bringing them up is that to describe how guidelines are sort of assessed. The first domain is scope and purpose, and you know how well is that described. The second domain is stakeholder involvement, which makes sense. Then they look at the rigor of the development, and that's one of the things that Mike and I often take issue with, is the rigor of the development, like how systematic was the look at evidence. Then the clarity of presentation, you know, are they providing ways in which actually normal humans can actually get the data out of it? how applicable are they, and what sort of editorial independence was there? And then they do an overall guideline assessment. And so there's a whole bunch of subheadings under each one of those domains, but that's kind of how they're looked at. And we're going to be referring to some of those assessments as we go through. Do you want to add anything to that, Mike, or are you okay?
I'm just wondering, you said normal humans. Do you think that abnormal humans can have a better chance of understanding the information presented in guidelines?
No, I think you to really do that, you need to be much closer to a godlike person.
There are other tools that you can look at too. If you're, Agree is probably one of the most established, but mm-hmm. you can go back a little bit into the archives and look at the user's guide to the medical literature. They have mm-hmm. a piece on interpreting guidelines. And there's also, you mentioned earlier, the Institute of Medicine and their definition, and they give some, what they call, and I think is quite cute, is guidelines you can trust.
Nice. That's
what the criteria are for that.
Yeah.
So there's a bunch of stuff out there that I think is quite helpful for evaluating the reliability and utility of guidelines.
Yeah. And then this is another thing that drives me crazy, is how recommendations are graded. That must drive you crazy as well, Mike, because there's so many different ways.
It does. It even with grade, and it drives me crazy that if you're an evidence-based assessor in writing guidelines, which we seem to be involved in, James, mm-hmm. much too
hard as me.
We have mixed interest in that, mm-hmm. I guess. But you're stuck using this kind of thing because it's become established, and there's a certain level of, well, they use grade, so we know it's good. And yet, when you look at the literature around grade, it requires dual reviewers, like so many things. How different reviewers will increase or decrease the score of the evidence mm-hmm. is really. And if you doubt this at all, you just have to go on and look at research around the scoring of grade and that kind of thing. And the kappa or agreement between people using grade is often very poor.
Mm-hmm.
So it might be great in principle. Even if it is great in principle, it falls apart in the human application, like so many things.
Yeah. Exactly. And so just so again, we'll give you some, we're not going to spend too much detail on this, but often when you, from a grade perspective, when they look at quality, they have sort of four levels of the gradings of the recommendations and so on. And the first one is high quality. And everyone who's listened to this podcast know how excited I get about the term high. But fortunately, when they say high quality, they explain it quite well by also calling it level A, which
yes.
really that helps a lot of things.
Yeah. Concrete now.
Yeah, exactly. But anyway, so high quality is where they say, and actually this is not an unreasonable statement. They say further research is very unlikely to change our confidence in the estimate effect.
I actually think that's, of all of the things that grade does and doesn't do, I actually like these definitions.
Yes, I do too. Yeah. The problem is I got to somehow remember what does high quality and what does level A mean, and
It's all about whether you think it's going to change or not.
Exactly. And then if you get to moderate quality, they say further research is likely to have an important impact on our confidence in the estimate and may change the estimate, or estimate of effect and may change the estimate. And then low quality is further research is very likely to have an important impact on our confidence in the estimate of effect and is likely to change the estimate. And then, so that's level C. And then what they call very low quality is any estimate of effect is very uncertain. Which means
then you're missing E, which is BS Medicine Podcast.
Yes, exactly. And then is F, which is almost the rest of medicine, where we're just going, I think this is right, or I know this is right.
Feels good.
Yeah, and then so they have those grades of, and like I said, I like the context of, you know, it's pretty unlikely that we're going to change based on new evidence. So that actually is quite helpful. And then they sort of grade the recommendation. So the first one was the quality of the recommendation, and now it's the recommendation, and they have a strong recommendation or a weak recommendation. And this is where I start to lose faith in or start to lose the will to live, is that they say the strong recommendation is when most informed patients would choose the option recommended and clinicians can structure their interactions with patients accordingly. Which flies absolutely in the face of shared decision making. And I know for a fact that these, when they say strong recommendation is where most informed patients would choose it, they have not assessed that.
You and your lofty goals.
I know. Who would want to assess it properly? But the way these sort of strong recommendations come out is they ask people who are making the guidelines, do you think most people would want to do this? And that's how they... And
it's a bunch of people sitting around a table who perseverate on this for a living.
Yeah. And you know, within that underlying issue is everybody's an individual, so it doesn't matter whether it's most. You can't figure it out unless you ask them. Anyway, we'll talk about that a lot more. And then there's a weak recommendation is when patient choices will vary based upon their values and preferences, and clinicians must help to ensure that patient care stays true to those values and preferences. So that's good. And in fact, you know, a strong recommendation, as an example, and I've used this as probably too often, is, you know, most people would like general anesthesia for surgery. So maybe that would be a strong recommendation. But anything under that, I think, comes down to a weak recommendation.
What about adrenaline for full-on anaphylaxis?
There you go. That's a pretty strong recommendation. Yeah, there's a fair number of those, but there's a lot more that we should be considering weak recommendations. Because if a weak recommendation is when we should identify values and preferences, that's many of them.
Yeah.
And then the one thing that came out recently. I hadn't actually thought of it, in the way that this was brought up. But it was an article done by Gordon Guyatt where they talked about that guideline panels should not grade what they called good practice statements. And there are many things out there that we all realize that we will never have great evidence to support, but that really are good practice. And there was an interesting article written in the Journal of Clinical Epidemiology just last year about the process that, you know, we guideline panels should not grade these sort of good practice points. And I think it kind of makes sense one example of what they called a good practice statement would be health services should be made available, accessible, and acceptable to sex workers based on the principles of avoidance of stigma, non-discrimination, and the right to health. I don't think you need to grade that statement because we're not going to have evidence for it, but it's a good practice statement. I think you'd agree with that, eh, Mike?
Yeah, you shouldn't demean or, you know, be cruel to your patients. I don't think we need an evidence statement for that or a grade statement.
Yeah.
That stands to reason, and hopefully we can all accept that as truth.
Yeah, and we don't have to have evidence for it.
Yeah, there's a lot of things we don't need evidence.
Yeah.
I don't need evidence to wear a parachute jumping out of a plane.
No, exactly.
Well, we actually have evidence for that. It's just not randomized controlled trials.
Exactly, yeah. It's N of one. And, you know, and another example was in patients presenting with heart failure, initial assessment should be made of the patient's ability to perform routine or desired activities of daily living. I mean, it's kind of common sense statements, but
I know.
They brought very appropriately a word of caution is required that really you can abuse this concept of good practice statements. You could just basically say, well, of course it's good practice to lower your LDL.
Yeah.
And then not say anything more from that. So those are some of the ways that sort of the grade way of looking at some of the clinical practice guidelines. But then also you see these levels of evidence, Mike, and I'm sure you've seen those as well.
Oh, and there's pyramids and blah, yeah, blah, blah. And everyone's like, they're now talking about making, you might have seen this too, James, making a different pyramid of evidence where meta-analysis isn't there on the pyramid because it's something distinct that summarizes the evidence,
yeah,
and blah, blah, blah. And I'm not for or against it. I'm just saying, like, we'll never be satisfied.
Yeah. But what they, and these grades of levels of evidence they have there, and they often, you'll see a recommendation in the guideline and then right next to it, it'll say 1A or 2B. And it always does that. And I can never remember what it means.
No. You just know that 1A is probably really good.
Yeah.
And that 3C is not so good.
Yeah. But anything in between, I've lost it. But, yes, but you know, there's 1A, 1B, 2A, 2B, 3, and 4. And you can envision it, again, almost on that pyramid, if you will.
Yeah. And in fact, you know, you and I might, we could, there is certainly room to quibble at the top, particularly comparing meta-analysis of a bunch of small trials compared to one big trial.
Exactly.
Trial. And I would say that, and it's interesting, in some of these grading systems, or sorry, levels of evidence system, LOEs, they're abbreviated. In those systems, you will see sometimes the large, well-done randomized control trial will trump the meta-analysis, and that, and I would probably agree with that in certain circumstances. But anyhow,
oh, yeah, and it really depends. If you have a you sort of do meta-analyses for two reasons. One is if you don't have evidence from individual trials on important outcomes like heart attacks and strokes, you add little studies together to get called a meta-analysis to identify that whether it does have an impact on these outcomes, or you're doing a meta-analysis of very large trials that have already looked at those issues and you're just trying to refine the estimate.
Right.
And so there's, so just because you have a meta-analysis, it could be a meta-analysis of little trials, or it could be a meta-analysis of very, very large randomized control trials, and they're very, very different.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And the little ones, to put them, a bunch of little trials, to put them as level 1A evidence is, it's tricky. It's potentially deceiving.
Yeah, exactly. And so, so there are many different ways of sort of categorizing levels of evidence and grades of recommendations and so on. And we just thought we'd bring some of those up to you guys to, so you realize that if you are confused, we understand.
we
live it.
We do this all the time. We're not quite, we're not totally confused on it, but I am often have to remind myself or even look. And interestingly, in individual guidelines, they will set different levels of evidence and strengths of recommendations and all of that kind of thing. So you often have to consult the individual guideline you're looking at, how they define those outcomes. Some don't even say, but
And we're going to talk a little bit later about people have gone back and looked at how many recommendations are based on certain types of levels of evidence. We'll talk a lot about that as we go through this. But so that's sort of how guidelines are assessed and how the sort of the recommendations are sort of categorized. And, you know, what I want to do just very, there'll be a number of podcasts on this, but I think we can just quickly talk about how do you use clinical practice guidelines? And I think there's a couple of key features that, you know, if I'm thinking of using a clinical practice guideline, which is not that often from the perspective of, I'm much more happy to know the best available evidence. But if you don't, and I would suggest if you don't know anything about evidence, I think at least clinical practice guidelines are a reasonable place to start. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially because the road to climb or the hill to climb, if you know nothing about the evidence, it would be a big one. And I think CPGs would be reasonable, but enter that journey with a certain amount of skepticism.
Right. No, exactly. And so, you know, there's a few key obvious questions that you need to ask yourself if you can look at a clinical practice guideline. You know, is it trustworthy? And that's actually a difficult thing to answer. I mean, one of the things that, Mike, you and I have always recommend people do is you identify either groups of people, individuals who you over time have sort of become to trust that they are providing you with reasonable information. And, you know, if you trust that the CMA can do something, or if you trust that the National Institutes of Health or whoever it is that's writing something, if you can trust them, then I think that's the first sort of step. But it doesn't guarantee quality.
No.
And then you obviously look to see if the guideline is applicable to your patient. You know, if you had two different guidelines, if you had a guideline of lipids in children, it obviously isn't going to be appropriate for adults, and vice versa, although I think we do translate it back down to children, you know, as an example.
Yep.
Yeah. And does the CPG, is the setting similar to your practice? And most importantly, does the CPG reflect you or your patient's values and preferences? And that is often not there, as you know quite well, Mike.
Yeah. Years ago, some Yahoo did some research on.
Yeah. We'll get that. We try not to promote his research.
Yeah. Yeah. He's under review.
But he is a tenured professor. I think it's important, Mike, to suggest that we are not the lone voice in saying things about guidelines, which I think you'd agree with that.
If anything, yeah, I mean, we are, not only are we not the only ones, but we weren't the first.
No, we weren't the first, and we're also not the most vocal, which is quite something.
It is something for sure.
Yeah. And, so there's been a number of groups of individuals who've sort of complained and said things like, that guidelines have a one-size-fits-all mentality, and bring up appropriate concerns that that these sort of guidelines are being turned into performance measures. And that is one of the issues that we've had.
Oh, for sure. Because there's a sense that this is the truth, mm-hmm. That it applies, as they said, to everyone, and therefore it needs to almost be forced on our patients that mm-hmm. they adhere to often targets and prescriptions that they might not want or might not even be reasonable for them for a whole bunch of other reasons.
No, exactly. Yeah, and there's you know, a number of people have also sort of commented on it that clinical practice guidelines can, you know, undermine clinical growth by, you know, getting people to just memorize facts versus learning principles, and that, you know, a lot of people are suggesting it would be much better if we could just educate clinicians to actually understand evidence and use it without sort of the filtered advice and all of that sort of stuff. And so we'll just take a couple more minutes and just talk about, you know, what guidelines probably should be like. And then I think the next podcast, Mike, why don't we start talking about what the evidence is around guidelines? Does that sound okay?
Perfect.
Yeah. So I think you would agree as much as I would, you know, there are certain procedures and things that need to be done where not only do we not need just guidelines, we should absolutely have very clear policies. You know, when there's an immediate life-threatening issues or very technical work, you know, like surgery, I want people who, you know, to count sponges before and afterwards.
Yeah, and also, you know, there's certain aspects to, and you've probably heard about this book, the Checklist Manifesto and that kind of thing, and they have certain application in medicine. I mean, to remember that when you're admitting a person with an MI, did you do the following things? Mm-hmm. And sure, you don't necessarily need to start everyone on A, B, and C, and D, and all that kind of thing, but you need to have thought
or yes, remember, exactly.
Consider it. And there's certainly a very a very important place for those kind of you know, standard orders, if you like, or that kind of thing, to remind us what we should be doing.
Yeah, and I think not just in medicine, but in other areas, those sorts of very checklist things have been shown to improve outcomes. We're not going to go over a detailed look at that evidence, but you know, that sort of stuff. So whether it be, you know, things like surgery or flying planes, if you will, or
yeah, that's where it started, was flying planes.
Exactly.
Introduction of just a checklist.
And you know, things like dispensing, you know, yeah, we're supposed to dispense the right medication, and there needs to be checks and balances for that. So we're not against anything.
James, I don't hold you accountable for those errors.
Don't you?
No, not for, you know, Everybody makes errors every 5 minutes.
Do they?
Yeah.
I cut it back to every 6 now. and I do that by just not doing as many.
Just refusing to fill more than
one. I just refuse to do anything. If you ask me to comment, I just say, I don't know. So,
or damn, they're paralyzed.
Yeah, exactly. So I think you would agree that in those sort of cases, you know, we are not against those sorts of guidelines or even like specific policies.
Right.
And then I kind of think of guidelines in two other ways. There are guidelines for treatment of symptoms. And I think you kind of need guidelines for those. But I think what most people really need is, because every person is an experiment, we just need a guideline that tells us what has the potential to work and if there's any comparisons, and then the overall safety. And I think if you had just that, I don't know what else you'd need for that, for guidelines.
I've often wondered this. So let's say you take a thing like osteoarthritis.
Mm-hmm.
If in a big table you laid out the estimated change in pain scores out of 10, mm-hmm. the number who will attain a 30% reduction, let's mm-hmm. say, improvement in function, again, make that out of a same scale. You can convert them to the same scale. And, you know, some of these core measures, quality of life, and then say the main harms.
Yeah.
And let people, and then let clinicians look and go, oh, you could maybe do something simple as ranking them based on likelihood of benefit versus likelihood of harm.
Yeah. Oh, don't be, now you're talking being practical.
It's insane, isn't it?
It is. Because if you do that, how can you possibly have a 30-page document?
I know. I'm ruining all those great guidelines that are 400 pages long.
Yeah, I know. But exactly the way you described it is probably the way it should be, especially for like the symptom stuff. And then, we put in the safety. And I think you could put in comments about, convenience. If you had to take it once a year, that would be more convenient probably than taking it every day, and the costs and so on. And let actually healthcare providers do what they probably should be very good at.
You don't mean to be clinicians again, do you?
No.
Okay, good. Because I didn't want to go there.
No.
Allowing things like judgment to get in the way of care.
Yeah, no, I would never judge judgment.
Nice.
Yeah, and then I think, somewhat similar where many of the big, what we call chronic disease state, and I hate that word because it's not that most of them aren't diseases, but chronic disease state guidelines like blood pressure, cholesterol, glucose, and so on, I think guidelines are required again to some degree for that, and to lay out what we know, but certainly not the clinical practice guidelines that we have right now don't do that well at all, where they talk about benefits and harms and the level that, what type of evidence is there and so on. But that's the sort of information that we need. And one of the things that I went, how could we make guidelines awesome? And I came up with three categories, and I think you probably agree with these. I hope, Mike, it's kind of back to the definition that the Institutes of Medicine gave. I think guidelines would be awesome if they were developed primarily by and definitely for the people that ultimately end up using them. And I think you agree with that.
Yeah. No, that's one of the core features.
Yeah. And unfortunately, that's not the case usually.
No. Why would that be there? Why would we go that way?
Yeah. Yep. So they fall a little flat in that area. They would be awesome if they were a credible synopsis of the best available evidence presented in a way that clinicians could easily access and interpret. not even close to that.
Keep going. You're
on. Well, I know. Top. It's sad. I'm you can't see me, but there's a tear coming out of my eye.
And someone must be stepping on your foot.
Yeah. And then the last thing would be, wouldn't it be awesome if they allowed patient values and preferences to be taken into account? And they don't really do that either.
Guidelines like this, James, are there?
There are people who try to do this. And usually they're basically cast aside or stoned. And I don't mean stoned marijuana. But they are physically, literally stoned.
Where is the Canadian podcast who are allowed to talk like that?
Yeah, exactly. So, now the next step now is we've sort of mocked guidelines with our last few comments here, but a lot of that comes from experience of looking at them, and the next few podcasts, probably one or two anyway, we're going to talk about how, evidence-based are clinical practice guidelines, who writes them, do they look at the sort of patient's values and preferences, and then we'll talk about the legal aspects of them and try and come up with some solutions at the end, although again, if we do come up with solutions, we'll just be stoned.
The solution is prayer.
Is it?
Yeah, that's the solution.
Well, why doesn't that go in a guideline?
It should. It has as much evidence as a lot of the recommendations.
Yeah.
Actually, it does have evidence. There is evidence for prayer.
Certainly, it is being looked at in an evidence-based fashion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and we probably won't discuss that during this podcast. We'll just hope that everyone prays for better guidelines.
That's what we're after.
Yeah. So, as always, we would love it if you would leave comments on iTunes. There haven't been many comments made recently, and I'm being the eternal optimist. I'm just assuming that people go, well, you already have lots of comments, so we don't need to put any more. Well, it would be nice if you could anyway, just because, especially if you're listening to these for free. Don't you think?
I was just going to say, James, we get more money from the drug companies if there's good comments.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I don't. Was I supposed to say that?
Oh, is that a problem? Well, we've never mentioned that all of these are subsidized. No, they're not. At least I'm not. I can't speak for Mike.
they would have nothing to do with us.
No, exactly. So if you could do that, and if you can continue to check out the Tools for Practice, which will be coming out at an incredible rate, and there is going to be a very special one coming up soon, right, Mike?
That is right. There will be a Christmas special edition.
So. Yes. So keep your ears open for that one. And go to our website on a regular basis. We'd love it if you become a premium member and give us a little something for Christmas. So
that's about as cheap as you've gotten.
No, I'm going to add, so we can feed the children.
Oh, nice. Take it to the next level. Exactly. It's Christmas.
Yeah. So there you go. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.